Hello, this is Manton Reese.
And this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Core Intuition. Everything is a trade-off.
Manton Reese, the new Apple is getting newer and newer all the time. I don't even know who Apple is anymore. It's a company. They're based in Cupertino in this big building called Infinite Loop. Wrong.
No.
Apple Park.
Everything's different.
Oh, they're they got this really egotistic CEO who gets into sparring matches with other companies and refuses to ever do business with them again. Wrong. That was a reference to Apple putting all of its data into Google's cloud services. Just had to sneak that in.
Although, slight correction, not all of their data. I think they split it between Google Cloud and Amazon Web Services.
Right.
They don't want to be dependent on only one company. Split it, then if something bad happens,
Smart. You know, that's probably even smarter than hosting it all on your own data centers. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is Apple definitely does not let its developers go out and do conference talks at third-party conferences. And they don't just willy-nilly, I'm dressing this up obviously, but they don't just willy-nilly open source frameworks at independent software development conferences in Japan. Is that where it was? I'm not sure. It's at the Tri-Swift conference, and I'm not 100% sure that it's in Japan at this moment, but I think it might be. Tri-Swift conference it's a great conference. I went to the New York City one a couple years ago. It's put on by Natasha the Nomad, as she's known on Twitter. A bunch of other people, of course, helping. But it's just, I'm really impressed with how consistently she's been putting these on. She's put them on in Japan and in New York, in India. She had at least one in India. So she's really cranking the Tri-Swift. And at this current, because I think this just came out today, this news. The current Tri-Swift conference, actually an Apple engineer, Norman Maurer, sorry, Norman, M-A-U-R-E-R, is a senior software engineer at Apple, formerly of Red Hat, who I guess has a pretty popular open source project that's not Apple-centric called Netty, N-E-T-T-Y. And at the Swift conference, he announced a new open source project from Apple, not just from him, and it's called Swift Neo or Swift Nio. It's Swift N-I-O, and you can check it out on github.com/apple/swift-nio. And looks pretty interesting. The high-level description is that it's a cross-platform, asynchronous, event-driven network application framework for rapid development of maintainable, high-performance protocol servers and clients. Wow, that's a lot of words. And then it says in brief after that, it just says it's like Netty but written for Swift.
Right, and of course, most people in the Apple community then have to go see what Netty is.
Right.
If you're from the Java world or something like that, maybe you're familiar with some of this stuff already. But
yeah,
and to me, the key word is the high performance that jumps out to me. Non-blocking, asynchronous. I mean, you use one of these frameworks if you need to get the most performance and handle many, many simultaneous connections. That's how I read most of the stuff.
Yeah.
In contrast to like a lot of the stuff I build, traditional web apps where you're always constrained with like the number of connections that can come in and how requests are processed.
Yeah. And I think, the other key thing that jumps, one key thing jumps out at me and then some things derive from that. The key thing that jumps out to me is, if I'm reading this right and I understand it correctly, it is a framework designed to facilitate efficient communication between clients and servers, but specifically to facilitate that communication when the client and the server are both written in Swift. And that's pretty interesting, both from a point of view of, well, obviously, it looks like this Netty project has a lot of fans, and anybody, I guess, who was already a fan of Netty is probably pretty excited to see something that allows that same approach to be adapted easily to Swift. But it's also interesting to me, I don't know if Apple hired this developer because of the work he had done on Netty. But the fact that Apple's willing to put out the project as an Apple branded, or not, or at least, you know, Apple stewarded project on GitHub, there's not that many of those yet. You know, there's a few. Like, I mean, Swift was the big one that came on to came. Well, now I'm looking. There's more than I thought. Jeez, but this is one I hadn't seen before. Turi Create simplifies the development of custom machine learning models. Well, they're sharing more than I knew. This makes me wonder. Like, I don't think Apple would do this unless they were planning to leverage and benefit from this on their own stuff. It sort of makes me think, okay, Apple must be really looking at Swift on the server and how they can use that in conjunction with Swift in their client software to do XYZ. I don't know what. Maybe make iCloud better, make iCloud SDKs for Apple developers better. I don't know what you do with this stuff, to be honest. But
right. You'd think they would have some plan, or maybe they're already starting to figure out how they can rebuild some of their server infrastructure. It's hard for me to know. I'm not an expert in this after 24 hours, obviously. And it's hard for me to know if this is useful at all to the way I think about the world, the way I build apps, basically web apps, you know, JSON, you know, like, especially if you're talking about like sending custom data structures back and forth. And like this may be more suitable to like non-open APIs, I guess is a better way to think about it. And so I don't know how useful it is. I mean, I'm fascinated with Swift on the server. I know a lot of people are experimenting. There's different frameworks, like higher level frameworks on this for building web apps. And it feels like maybe eventually there'll be something there, but I'm still not sure how it's all going to shake out, especially because Swift, it's still not a very dynamic language the way we're used to having languages to build web apps. And so, I mean, I'm having trouble grasping how like far reaching a project like this will actually be.
Yeah, well, here's what's interesting to me. Another interesting thing is we went into this, Jack, and I said, I'm gonna have no trouble, or I said, Jack, sorry. I got a message from my friend Jack that popped up on my screen that confused me. Manton, we went into this, Manton, with me saying that I have no, hesitation to admit my lack of knowledge in this domain. It's like, even though I work a lot with networking APIs, I don't really have a strong understanding about like what all the goals are that are, being attempted to achieve here, how this relates to like how people typically do web services, et cetera. But I don't think that Apple like held this guy against his will and said, make this thing work in Swift. He probably thinks it's like somehow kind of a nice setup. Mm-hmm. And he, I imagine, has a lot of experience in this domain. So,
well, and he might have been experimenting with this before he was hired, for all we know.
That's true. Like
he might have he might have shown interest in fiddling with Swift and, kind of embracing the Swift world, and then Apple picking him up to finish and fund the rest of the work.
Yeah.
I still have this, God, I feel like it's been years now, but I still, my relationship with Swift hasn't significantly changed. I'm actually working on a project for a client that is 100% Swift. You know, I've been obviously putting so much time into MicroDotBlog, but I'm still juggling a couple other projects kind of on the side from MicroDotBlog. And so there's one that's in Swift, and I still don't love it. I'm still not sure what to do with this language. I wish I loved Swift more, because then these server projects would be even more interesting to me.
And then this is just so great. It's kind of like life just made our paths diverge for the sake of drama on Core Intuition, because I've gotten to the point where I'm like looking for things to convert to Swift. I'm like, I'm done. I'm like, whatever that, take the Swift pill. I took the Swift pill, I guess. I want to add quickly, I clicked through on this Norman Maurer's GitHub page, and he's credited there as a senior software engineer in the cloud infrastructure engineering group. Mm-hmm. So that strongly suggests to me that this is work in the service of supporting Apple's own cloud storage stuff, whatever it is.
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, Apple's not the kind of company that just randomly builds things without having a purpose for them.
No.
And of course, it ships on day one for Linux and servers. You know, it's not, this is not like a project that you need to build in Xcode. This is something that from the very beginning was designed to run cross-platform.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the, yeah, it's, I like that. It's very interesting that it says in, you know, in the Apple, and I shouldn't be too surprised. I know Swift is cross-platform as well, but, you know, just to see, this isn't an Apple for, platforms technology. So that is interesting.
And you can go back through the commit history on this project. And like, I think the Swift project, this is kind of the same thing where it's public now, but he's been working on this for a long time. I mean, I'm scrolling back to almost a year ago, and it probably goes further back in GitHub. So I don't know when Apple hired him, but he's been working on this for a long time. And if they hired him a while ago, possibly full-time, like it's possible a lot of engineering has already gone into this project.
So I guess, folks, if you know a lot about Netty, maybe drop us a line and put this into perspective for us. And or if you just look at this framework and you can think of like really obvious ways that this is going to adapt itself to Apple's interests or to other developers' interests, might be interesting to hear what some of you folks think about it.
Yeah, when I think of performance, I always think about like the one huge, I mean, there's lots of different bottlenecks in Micro.blog that I can improve, but like the big one is the background work that it needs to do to like download like thousands of RSS feeds and JSON feeds and like check them all the time. And this is the same kind of scaling problem that, you know, podcast clients that have a server component have. You know, RSS readers that have a server component. There's a lot of types of apps that have this, but anytime I see some kind of server optimization, fast, something like that, that's what I think. Is like, can I use this to help me on the parts of my app that need to scale and that are not as fast as they can be? Because all my server stuff is Ruby, which is notoriously like the slowest of like when you pick a handful of server languages. And of course, Swift is much, much faster with the trade-off that it's not, in my opinion, very well suited to doing kind of server programming. Certainly, it would be difficult to port some of my existing code, I think, to Swift without major changes.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting distinction now, too, between you and I, because when we started this show, you and I were both exclusively, I would say, for the most part, exclusively writing Mac Objective-C code.
Yeah.
And over the years, things have shifted. You wrote, you know, for a while there, you were writing mostly iOS Objective-C code. Mm-hmm. And I was still writing Mac Objective-C code. And then for a while, you were writing mostly Ruby or whatever. Yep. That's the official language, Ruby or whatever. and I was still writing Mac Objective-C code. And then you were writing like this, that, and the other thing. Now you're writing mostly Ruby again? Is that what Micro.blog on the server is? You said, just said?
Yep. It's all Ruby on the server and then Objective-C on the client.
And now I have just finally, it's like, I'm a slow changer, I guess, but I finally change. And then I'm just like, I have to tell you, Manton, it surprises me as much as it might surprise you. I'm just like, I'm just not missing Objective-C at all when I don't use it. Huh. It's fascinating to me. And I think what it is partly too, I think we mentioned this, I mentioned this on another show, but partly it's just this allure of these features of the language that kind of get me interested in programming again. Like I don't want to go overboard with them, but you know, things like generics or, you know, sometimes I'll just be writing some code and I'll be like, you know what? It would be really handy to have a type that's just right here in this class. And I know you could just write the type in the source file in Objective-C, but it feels differently. Or like I just want to write a function here in this class. And I might be making weird stylistic mistakes, but every time I do one of those things, I think, wow, I wouldn't be able to do this in Objective-C. And to some extent, I can see an argument for like, well, you're giving yourself too much rope to hang yourself with. And there's something beautiful about like, you know, if you're an artist, like get all your colors to fit on one palette so you can actually like work without, you know, having to switch between 60 palettes. But I think there's some compromise for the kind of work and the efficiency of the work I want to do combined with, it turns out, like, I think this is what a lot of us are experiencing this as like longtime Objective-C developers who thought for years and years and years that we didn't care about or definitely, you know, we're willing to do without like strict type safety. the more and more I get used to it, I'm like, you know what? I kind of like this. And could also be kind of like my brain changing as I get a little older. Could be that I'm like more dependent on the computer to help me. I don't know. But there's something kind of like all the loose ends tied together feeling about the way I feel when a Swift code chunk kind of works.
Interesting. I'm still, I'm not there. And, you know, I'm not going to bash on Swift. I mean, people love it. Mm-hmm. And most people seem to be moving to or starting there. That's fine. And there are many parts of the language that are very elegant that I like. Any part that reminds me of C++, I don't like. So like when you talk about generics, when you talk about type safety, I mean, I don't know. I'm so used to, I programmed for many years in many older languages, and it's so refreshing still for me to use a dynamic language that never complains, no matter what bad code I throw at it. But my problem with Swift actually lately, so this project is Swift 3.2, I believe, and just the rapid changes that Swift has gone through, and then the way Swift has changed how it interacts with Apple's frameworks. It's a temporary problem, but it's a real problem now if you want to like search the web for help on a certain part of your project, because there's so much example code that does not work anymore in significant ways.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like Swift, the language itself, but again, the way you're used to thinking about, if you have a dozen years of experience using AppKit or UIKit, the way you're used to thinking about class names in the framework has also changed. So that's kind of fascinating as well. Again, temporary problem, but it is, you do have this like so much documentation and Stack Overflow questions on the web that are just no longer correct.
No, you're absolutely. And to some extent, I kind of feel like I gradually started nudging myself. It's been a couple of years now, I think, since, remember, I think it was a couple of years ago when I said on this show, like, oh, I'm going to do this weird thing. I'm just going to start reading the Swift like manual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little bit every day.
Yep. And then, it's one of these things where I remember feeling very overwhelmed by the language and overwhelmed by every little error that I got. And at some point I crossed this like threshold of understanding, where I guess, it's that feeling you get when you're learning anything new, when you get to a point where you feel very confident that you can figure out the problem, like maybe not quickly, but once you get to that point with anything new where you say, okay, I don't know everything, but I know I can figure this out. That changes everything. Cause it no longer feels like this. Like I know that frustration you're talking about. You just don't want the compiler to keep, smacking you down as you're trying to do something. And I think some of it is just kind of getting used to knowing what to do. And some of it is, I guess, being more, definitely there's something to it where it's like, I'm more resilient about not minding if the compiler strikes me down sometimes.
You tend to be more strict too with like, treat warnings as errors and things like
that. Yeah, well, right? That's a big thing. If that is a distinction, then yes, absolutely. I've always had treat warnings as errors on. And I guess that's just a philosophical, that would explain some difference of a take on it, because that's like a personality thing where I'm like, that was me in a type unsafe language saying to the compiler, strike me down as much as you can. So I can definitely relate. If that is not your strategy with Objective-C, then I could see how it would be that much harder to embrace Swift.
It's a goal, but I'm not strict about it, and I don't have it enabled. So I'm looking in the latest project that I'm working on. Actually about to ship a brand new app, Sunlit 2.0. So brand new version of an old app. Yep. And it's going to ship soon, actually. I think I'm probably going to submit to Apple maybe even today.
Oh, wow.
And maybe tomorrow. And I'm looking at it now, and there's a handful of warnings. There's not like hundreds of them. There's a handful. And some of them look fairly new from a refactor, and they could easily be cleared up. And some of them, it looks like they all could be cleared up pretty quick. But certainly, I've definitely had projects in the past that have like kind of started accumulating warnings. And deprecations and like things that just take time to clean up. And it, I would never argue that you're doing it wrong. I think it's very valuable not to let those accumulate, but I still ship software that has build warnings in it. And as long as I know that they're okay.
Well, that's the thing. I do that too, but I use the system to formalize that. So if I ship a warning that I know is okay, then I just do the thing where you put the little pragma push diagnostic, ignore this thing. So I force myself,
I don't know. I feel like that's worse.
It's not to me because I can search on any diagnostics that, you know, first of all, I don't put that in there until I've decided that I do believe it's harmless. And so there's no imminent harm in leaving it there forever or really. But then, you know, if I ever want to clean up, I can just search on that pragma. Okay. And the thing is, it keeps me from having to, like, some people might turn off the warning across the board if they wanted to get rid of the warnings, but it just lets me like put it on the one that I, for whatever reason, can't easily fix.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's certainly something like to be said for not wanting to be nagged all the time about things that you're not going to address.
Right.
You know, they're safe, but you can't easily, it's not like a deprecated API that like you, it just takes a few minutes to like use a different one or something like that. I mean, it's stuff that you're not going to fix. So you don't want to be bothered by it all the time.
Yeah. And I think I told you this a while back, my strategy is also not strict in the sense that I allow warnings in debug builds. So, I let the warnings, like when Apple makes new deprecations, I let them build up and I see them on my development machine. But, If it doesn't make a warning on my release machine, this gets back to the thing again, of course, where we use different machines for build and release, then it's not gonna stop my build from being released because it doesn't generate any warnings on the build machine. So anyway, it's complicated. It's a little fussy. I agree, but then no, that's a good point. That is, it's weird because I look around my office. And I've talked about this on the show before. My office is a nightmare. I'm looking at my desk and there is so much disarray. If I had the attitude about code warnings, if I had that attitude about my office, it would be like the most anal retentive.
It would be empty. It would just be like a laptop on the ground and you would sit down and cross your legs and just like, and maybe there's a little mat.
Tiffany lamp in the corner.
Right. I'm looking at my desk now and it is an absolute disaster. It's the worst it has ever looked. It's so bad. You know how you have those sites like the Sweet Setup is one. There's a couple others where it's like once a week they highlight someone's like home screen and like their computer setup, and it always has a picture of their desk and it's always perfect, right?
Yeah.
It's like clean. There's the keyboard there. Maybe there's some well-placed photos. I think it'd be great to have a site that's it would be something that would be the opposite. It would be like, what's the worst your desk has ever looked? And then it's pictures of that. And it's like a screenshot of your Mac's like the desktop's all cluttered up with like clean up this folder and, you know, all sorts of extra files.
Yeah. I had, a few years ago, I had the fun / weird obligation of having a photo shoot in my office for the Macworld, ran a little like back page column about my office. I think it was my, like, I don't know. I don't remember. It's like, I think it was, the adaptation by Macworld of, oh gosh, why am I spacing on it now? But there was the site that like talked about all the different tools you use and stuff like that. Anyway, I'll figure it out and put it in the show notes, but they did this photo shoot. It was totally like you described. They came to my house to take a picture of me in my office. And I basically, before they even got there, I like basically took everything off my desk and put it in the corner. And then when they got there, they were like, this isn't interesting enough. And they were like, you need to stack up like a big stack of tech books on either side of your desk, because that's going to give a little texture. And then like, why don't we put your laptop up on some books too? And like, I see you have an iPad over there. Why don't you prop that up next to the MacBook? And I'm like, I never use that. Like, doesn't matter. This is to look good. And I have to say, it looked great. I mean, it looked weird, but...
It's a lie, though. It's a lie.
It's a total lie. But, but, you know, it would have been... At the same time, I really didn't want the... I mean, I'm embarrassed by my messy aspects.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my problem... I'm not embarrassed. Like, if someone came in and saw my desk, I wouldn't be embarrassed. But I am, I guess, a little ashamed of how... It affects the fact, like, for example, like, there's a stack of, like, unopened mail. Like, that has a very negative effect on my ability to be productive and mm-hmm. process whatever is in that envelope that I should be taking care of. And, like, that bothers me because there's a lot of stuff I lose track of. I don't know. I think about that. Well, you know that Einstein photo where it's, like, his desk is just a... Absolute uh-huh. disaster. Yeah. Yeah, there's always...
He doesn't have time to clean his desk. He's busy inventing the future.
Yeah. The problem, and this is the same thing with code, right? It's like, you know, warnings that we're talking about is, yeah, if the messy desk starts affecting... I mean, I don't want to... This sounds like I don't care if my desk is messy. I do care. It's bad. And my wife probably comes in and it's like, oh my God, this is a disaster. But like the other... problem is when it affects your ability to be productive and get things done. And that's the same thing with Xcode as with the real world. Yeah. When things are too messy, dishes pile up, desk is messy, whatever.
Well, you know, there's a balance. And I often think like maybe I am less productive because my desk is a mess, not because it's getting in the way of me like moving my fingers on the keyboard of my computer and seeing the screen change, but because, you know, I occasionally look around and I think, God, this place is a mess. It just distracts me yeah. from my work. Or, you know, maybe there's definitely some times where I'm like, oh, I actually can't move my mouse as much as I usually could because there's too much junk in the way.
That's a sign. See, I don't have that problem because I don't have a mouse.
There you go. So just... Oh, well. You know, I think that's interesting, though. I think that you should get you got to get down to no warnings. We got to make this life change for you, and then yeah. that's just a baby step towards embracing Swift and all the nanny code nannying it can do for you.
Nah, not this year. I think it's going to be a while. Actually, I had one Swift source file, maybe one or two, yeah. in micro.blog that was some shared code someone else had written. I was like, this is going to save me a lot of time. I'm going to use the share code someone else wrote. It's in Swift. Yeah, that's wow. fine. You know, enable all the bridging header, do all the fancy stuff, make it work. And that was fine. And I even tweaked that code in Swift a few times because I wanted to fix a couple things. But I reached a point maybe a few weeks ago, a month ago, where I wanted to significantly change how that code worked. And I tried and I tried. But the problem wasn't that it was in Swift. The problem was the code was just structured completely wrong for what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I threw the whole thing out, rewrote it in Objective-C, and it's like a fourth the size. I'm not kidding. It's way less, and it does twice as much. And it's clean.
That's fascinating, because a lot of people have the experience that Swift makes things smaller.
The problem isn't, again, it's not so much Swift as... the code, the way
the specific code that you have.
Yeah, yet. And it's also like, it's my style of programming, so I can understand it more. It's like not necessarily better or worse. It's just I wrote it, so I know exactly everything.
Yeah.
But it really, like that particular code, I don't necessarily want to blame Swift, but there was a lot of code to do not much. And, you know, some programmers, they handle everything. And I don't mean like you shouldn't handle every use case, but like some programmers, they build like, it's just like all this cruft kind of accumulates, right. All these edge cases yeah. and all these different things. And in reality, a lot of that code, if you sit down and you look at it, all that code that's been accumulating, like if this is a shared code project, open source that maybe been around for a few years or more, all that extra code that's been accumulating doesn't always serve the app that you've put it in. And so right. by starting over, it was just cleaner and simpler.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's anytime you're working with something that has ambitions of serving as a library of some sort, then right. you're going to have all these edge cases and all these different particulars that don't apply to you. And that totally makes sense. I do think it's interesting and funny, though, because in this particular juncture in my developer life, for better or for worse, and I know that there's a lot of people out there listening who think it's for better, and at least a few who think it's for worse, I am just like proactively like refusing to pretty much refusing to write new Objective-C code. And so I'll go so far as like, I'll write a little Swift extension on my Objective-C classes just to avoid writing one function, one new method in Objective-C.
Yeah.
And then, so I think it's funny, this contrast is great because we have you actually rewriting something that was in Swift, and granted it wasn't your own code, but rewriting, you took Swift away. And in your case, if it really is only one Swift file, I mean, you get a you gain a lot, yeah, at least.
My builds are a lot faster, yeah, just by getting rid of that, yeah, one.
Well, and you don't have to carry that weight of that. I mean, the one thing that kept me from diving into Swift, you know, whole hog for a long time was it's more of like a psychological thing, but the knowledge that heavy library bundle is going to come with the app, it still bothers me, even in my enthusiasm for the language.
Interesting.
I was actually thinking about this today, coincidentally, because for some reason I ended up looking at my Shush, now called Swish, app on the iOS. It's my only iOS app in the App Store. And as it stands in the App Store, I remember when I shipped it first on the App Store, one of the reviews pointed out how it was impossible. It was so impossibly small that the App Store reported it as 0.0 kilobytes. Or no, it was 0.0 megabytes, I guess. Oh, probably.
Okay.
And I was kind of proud of that because, you know, it had like, I don't know, zero resources and just like was all code. And then I added some resources and it's like, oh, now it's like 500K or something, you know? And then, and now I'm looking at it. I had this instinct to make a Swift file in it because I was like just making some little minor change. And then I realized, oh, this one might actually qualify for my stubborn refusal to switch to Swift, because it would take it from being like 1 megabyte to like 16 megabytes probably. And maybe that's overstating, probably 10 megabytes, but. And I have to like constantly remind myself, like actually nobody in the big scheme of things cares if an app is 1 megabyte or 10 megabytes these days.
As long as it's small-ish, it doesn't matter. So this doesn't weigh into my thinking really at all. My apps are pretty lightweight and small. It only starts to matter, and this is usually games, but I could see very large bloated cross-platform frameworks or something else maybe be a problem. But yeah, if you get to like 20, 30, 40, 50 meg, then you know, you start running into problems of like, well, it's going to be a little slower for someone to download over cellular and, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think the Swift tax, so to speak, in the libraries that are bundled caps out at about 10 to 15 megabytes. So I don't think it ever gets much worse than that.
That doesn't bother me too much. I was looking at, there's another new framework that actually was released, I believe just this week, called Flutter. And this is from Google. And it's a new framework for building iOS and Android apps from the same code base. And we don't need to go into like the trade-offs with doing that. It looks like they've actually done a nice job in terms of like, you can apply like the iOS look or the Android look, and it actually does look like it fits in really well on the platform. I haven't tried the code or anything, but one of the interesting things that stood out to me is they call this out in their documentation. They mention that there is a cost in just bundling the framework in, and they say it's 6.7 megabytes approximately for a, like a empty app that does nothing. It's still going to be like about 7 megabytes. And I found that interesting that they mentioned that, and it's good, but that doesn't stop me. Like if I wanted to use this, I would certainly not be stopped by an extra 7 megabyte.
That's an interesting metric by which native apps and web apps still, you know, diverge greatly. Like if you asked somebody to take a 7 megabyte hit on a web framework,
right,
that would be like, oh, heck no. Right.
Yeah.
I think that's still the case. I mean, you know, like jQuery or something like that's like something tiny, right? It's like in the K probably.
Right.
And it's all about page loads, of course, but you know, when you have the luxury of downloading once and running multiple times, as you do on a native app, that's kind of an interesting advantage because, it's no big deal to download 7 megabytes, even 20 megabytes, if it's really powerful and useful. And whatever it is in that 7 megabytes, I'm sure that it's pretty much like nothing can come out. So that would imply that there's functionality in there that you can't get, say, downloaded into JavaScript on a web app, unless you're also willing to download 7 megabytes worth of data.
Yeah, it looks like an interesting framework. And if I hadn't have built like MicroDotBlog for iOS and I wanted a Android and iOS app, I might consider, I don't know,
yeah,
probably not, but I might consider looking at something like that at least a little bit. I'm super happy with the way my apps work right now, though, and having Objective-C, which I'm also happy with, but like the balance of like the technology that I'm using the apps, I think works well. I was kind of curious when you were saying that about web apps. So Slack, of course, is not a web app. I mean, the Mac version is not a web app, but of course it uses web views heavily. It uses Electron, the framework for making native apps out of web apps. Mm-hmm. And that app is a little over 200 megabytes download. I found that kind of interesting that it's that big, because it seems like most of the resources would be loaded from the web.
I think that's mostly the Electron stuff.
Yeah, like all the Chrome, like JavaScript engine and all, like all that stuff. It's like you have to have, basically you have to have the size of a web browser in your app.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking randomly on my Mac and looked in the Slack app. I'm a little confused by this. It looks like, I'm confused by this GetInfo. Maybe I've spent a long time since I looked at GetInfo. I don't know what to make about this, because it says in the Finder GetInfo window, it says 129.7 megabytes. You know, this might be some, this, you know what I think this is? I'm looking at something maybe like some macOS compression on disk thing. Because it says, because when it says the breakdown, it says, so Electron framework inside the Slack app is 130 megabytes.
Right. I'm seeing that, yeah.
Answers a lot of the question of like, why is this thing so dang big?
Yeah.
But if you look at the size, it says, yeah, 129 million bytes. I don't know what the, yeah, that's right. And then it says in parentheses, 56.2 megabytes on disk. So, hey, thanks Apple for saving me some space. Nice. But that's like clearly the majority of what's taking up the space in this app.
Now that you said that, of course, that makes perfect sense. There's probably very little of the Slack specific stuff in the app. And of course it doesn't matter that much. I mean, yeah, you know, we can again debate about how Electron apps work, but like the fact that it's a 200 megabyte download just doesn't matter that much.
It's funny because I simultaneously believe that it doesn't matter at all and that it's the worst crime against programming in the history of programming, because yeah, it just disgusts me to think that this thing takes 180 megabytes to be a custom browser,
yeah,
around a Slack page.
And so, and when I say it doesn't matter, I'm thinking of, you know, on the Mac, you're usually on Wi-Fi and it's a download, yeah, you do once, maybe you do it again in a few weeks, but it's not very often. That would be very huge, I think, for a mobile app. So I would definitely not want to be downloading a 200 megabyte iOS app. But yeah, by comparison, Mars Edit, very mature app. It's been on its fourth major version, is a nice 30 megabytes or so.
That looks right.
MicroDotBlog, only 5-6 megabytes. So small.
And that Mars Edit 30 megabytes does include the Swift tax.
Yeah.
So I'm not sweating it either. But you know, when you look at this, like something like the, all these Electron apps, like you look at Slack and you say, okay, it's 200 megabytes. It's not that big of a deal, but when every app, no matter how complex or simple, starts, yeah, being 200 megabytes, then it just sort of starts to bug you. And so it's like, you know, people who think like, oh, well, the future of apps is these Electron apps. Well, maybe, but if so, you got to get some centralized infrastructure in place, because that's just a... Boy, thanks for pointing that out, because, or reminding me, because that just makes me think the Swift baggage is nothing.
It really is nothing. I mean, I can complain about a lot of things with Swift, but that, yep, is not anything I would complain about. Like, I don't even think I would have it in the top 10 complaints. It's really not an issue. And of course, you know, at the end of the day, you've got a native app that you can optimize however you see fit. Whereas with Electron, you carry a lot of things with you that you can't get rid of. And like, yeah, the 200 megabytes, actually, I would put as below the top thing, which is that like if you've got, as you said, if you have a bunch of Electron apps on your Mac, it's like running a bunch of copies of Chrome or something. You know, it's not super great for memory and performance.
No, right. Yeah. Right. They don't even get to well, maybe they do if there's some fancy Mac OS sharing thing. Nah, that's right. That's different code signatures, all that jazz. So I'm sure they don't share that. Anyway, that's kind of a interesting avenue to explore my extreme biases and yours. I guess we got to get back to the, you know, this is one of those things where kind of like before I shipped Mars Edit 4 and before, you know, you shipped micro.blog, there's all these things where you tell yourself like, no, this is really important. I can't ship unless I do this. And this is kind of that mindset that gets me tripped up sometimes where it's like, no, I can't use Swift because I'll take on a 10 megabyte penalty. Mm-hmm. And otherwise this is a 0.0 megabyte app. And there's things, many, many, many things in this world and in the developer mindset that are only important to the developer. And those are not the things you want to necessarily obsess on. I guess I should say it's good to trust what you think is important. But if you're like me, sometimes the things that you get obsessed on and think are important, I mean, the trade-off for focusing on that is that you don't get something else important done, mm-hmm. you know?
Right. Everything is a trade-off, and it's good to think about the user experience kind of fallout from this, because that's really what we're talking about. It's not the fact that it bothers us that it's taking up the hard drive space or the memory or whatever. It's like, what effect does that have on the user when they're downloading the app, when they're using it day-to-day?
Yeah.
But also, if it could make you 100 times as productive and you could ship your app instead of not shipping it out, your app, well, maybe that's worth it.
Yep. Well, Manton, let's ship some apps.
Sounds good. I will be doing that. So this Sunlit, this app, I'm about to start promoting it even more, and I have high hopes. Maybe we'll talk about it next week, but I think it's a really interesting app. It's all about photos. I've got some stuff in my blogs about it, but I think it has potential to be really interesting because it doesn't require a micro.blog account, but it works really well with micro.blog. So mm-hmm. it's the first app that I've shipped in a long time that anyone can just download in the App Store and use it. So I'm excited about it. So wrapping it up, not adding any Swift code, but hopefully it'll be out pretty soon over the next week.
Hopefully by the next time we record Core Intuition, we'll be able to... That gives you a goal. By the next time we record Core Intuition, we'll be able to talk about Sunlit 2.0. So we'll see you folks in about 4 months.
Right? Yeah. We'll see how many Apple rejections I have to go through. Yeah. And then that'll...
They're going to say, well, it looks here like maybe you had a few code warnings.
You never know. Actually, I started getting an error when I submit to when I just upload it to TestFlight. I've been getting some, like, you've got a lot of extra symbols, some weird mm-hmm. error from iTunes Connect. So I don't know what that's about. That just started happening. So you never know what kind of weird edge case thing will trip up App Review.
Yeah, that's true. And I told you about when I did Mars Edit 4, there were a bunch of things that didn't come up at all until I submitted to Apple, and then suddenly it's like, oh, I got to redo all this jazz. Mm-hmm. Like, never, you don't. That's like the final compile phase, is submitting to the App Store.
Yeah. Well, thanks. We'll talk to you again next week, and everyone, thanks for listening to the show this week. Of course, if you have any feedback@coreit.org. If you have any questions or feedback about the show.
And, of course, you might have noticed we didn't have a sponsor this week. We're sort of dropping the ball on booking our sponsors. We need to get on that. But if you happen to know somebody, some company that has great product targetable to our audience of iOS, mainly iOS and Mac developers, encourage them to get in touch with us because we are not good salespeople in that respect. Of course, this show in particular being ad-free, if you feel inspired to support us directly, as always, we have our membership, coreint.org/membership. And we'll look forward to talking to y'all again next week.
All right, see ya.